the use of telecom companies?
Right. So GCHQ and NSA believe that, essentially anything is justified as long as it gets them to where they want to be. The engineers at Gemalto, you know, were not accused of, breaking the law. Gemalto itself is not a criminal enterprise. But the these governments want the keys that Gemalto has, and so they're willing to do, you know, anything it, takes to, get that. You know, in the last few moments that I have, I really want to let your listeners know that there are things that you can do right now to protect your communications. That the telephone companies have not shown any interest in providing us with secure communications. You cannot trust the voice or text message services provided by your wireless carrier. So you need to download apps. There are some built into the, iPhone, iMessage, and FaceTime. There are tools like WhatsApp that are distributed by Facebook, and there are some even better tools like Signal, which is supported by the U.S. government, actually. You can download apps and services and make encrypted telephone calls, send encrypted text messages that governments cannot easily intercept, but those tools will not be provided to you by your telephone company. You need to take steps and take matters into your own hand.
Chris Segoyan, I want to thank you for being with us, privacy researcher and activist with the ACLU. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We'll link to Jeremy Scahill's piece at democracynow.org.
The time is now 5 p.m. This is KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a live performance by West African artist Alpha Yaya Diallo on February 28th at 9 p.m. at the historic Bob White Theater in Portland. Diallo is the three-time winner of the Canadian Juno Music Award, and his performance ends the celebrations of Black History Month. Again, that's West African artist Alpha Yaya Diallo, Saturday, February 28th at 9 p.m. at the historic Bob White Theater, 6423 Southeast Foster Road in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio and Students United for Palestinian Equal Rights are proud to sponsor a panel discussion called Occupation, Environmental Destruction, and the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, a panel discussion on international resistance this Tuesday, February 24th at the PSU Smith Center Ballroom. This panel will feature the Portland appearance of Palestinian intellectual and activist Omar Barghouti, as well as Kanahus Manuel, mother of four and First Nations anti-mining activist from British Columbia, Cecily Saraski, communications director of Jewish Voice for Peace, and Dr. Michael Yellowbird, professor of sociology and anthropology and director of Indigenous Peoples Studies at North Dakota State University. That's Occupation, Environmental Destruction, and the Boycott, Divestment, and Sanctions Movement, a panel discussion on international resistance, February 24th at PSU's Smith Center Ballroom, 1825 Southwest Broadway in Portland. More information on the KBOO webpage on the right side under Community Events.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Oregon's new governor, Kate Brown, extends a moratorium on executions in the state.
While protesters gather outside Ron Wyden's home in southeast Portland, calling on him to oppose the fast-tracking of the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade agreement.
Newly released documents have confirmed the existence of an Israeli nuclear weapons program since at least the 1980s.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, February 20th, 2015. I'm Paul Rowland.
And I'm Linda Olson-Osterlund. Labor, environmental, and community rights groups across the country, including here in Portland, are in the midst of a week of activism to bring attention to efforts by some U.S. senators to fast-track the so-called Trans-Pacific Partnership through Congress. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, or TPP, is a NAFTA-style trade agreement between the United States and 11 other nations circling the Pacific Ocean and would affect roughly 40% of the world's economy. All negotiations shaping the TPP have taken place in highly secret meetings with virtually no transparency or input from the public or non-corporate advocacy groups. The limited information that is available to the public has been leaked. It indicates that the trade agreement would loosen labor laws, establish corporate authority in regional lawsuits, water down environmental regulations, and prioritize corporate monopolies over economic diversity. Senate Finance Committee Chairman Orrin Hatch has stated he wants to introduce fast-track legislation for the TPP that would allow the Obama administration to bypass congressional review and avoid a period of inquiry into the trade agreement. Oregon Senator Ron Wyden, who previously opposed the fast-tracking legislation, over the last week has voiced support for it. Today, he published a statement that no fast-track hearing will be necessary in Congress, but activists are concerned about his wavering on this important issue. A group of activists have set up a protest, including a tent, where they're ready to wait for Wyden at his home in southeast Portland. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with Paige, one of the protesters at Senator Wyden's house.
Wyden is actually in quite a unique position. He is the leading Democrat that is on the committee within the Senate that is kind of charged with moving forward this free trade agreement, which is with 12 different countries and has been negotiated in secret. Corporate lobbyists have had access to seeing it and, offering suggestions and things like that. But it hasn't been open to even to our, congressmen and representatives and stuff. So it's been negotiated in secret, and fast track would be the way that it would get passed through there with basically an up or down vote. They'd have limited discussion, but they wouldn't have an open debate where amendments could be made and that sort of thing. So we're saying no. In fact, we don't want this kind of free trade to be advanced, in the United States. And we especially don't want it under the kind of circumstances of fast track. And so we are out here in front of his house today, and we're just trying to make our message be heard.
And what I understand the text of a draft of the Trans-Pacific Partnership was leaked. What do you see as some of the main problems with this Trans-Pacific Partnership?
Yeah, some of the main problems are the same kinds of things we've seen in other free trade agreements. So things like investor-state protections, where corporations have the ability to sue nations that make regulations on environmental issues. That basically anything that the corporation can argue is something that is a regulation that affects its bottom line, they can challenge. They can take countries to court. And as we're seeing, corporations are ending up with budgets that are much higher than, they just have more power than even a lot of countries at this point. So it's a very dangerous sort of thing. Also, there are rules that make it so that medicines can have longer patents. And so that makes it so that we can't get generic versions of them. So a lot of people that have, a real need for medicine are not able to get that. And it just, the list goes on and on.
So right now you're protesting outside of Ron Wyden's house that here in Portland?
Yeah, we are. And it's a little bit south of Reed College. And I want to mention that this is his second house. He primarily resides with his family in New York. He's not in Oregon very often, and we really don't feel like he's representing Oregon's interests.
And there is a simultaneous protest going on in New York?
Yeah, there is. We have a group of people that are in New York that are doing a simultaneous protest in front of his house there.
So how is it that that Ron Wyden has houses in both places? I was under the impression that he was an Oregonian.
Well, Ron Wyden is from Kansas, and he has represented Oregon for a number of years. But he's married to a New Yorker, and he has several grown kids from his first wife, and his current wife him and his current wife have young children that they're raising in New York.
Wow. And you said that he has a lot of influence on this issue, that he could play a deciding role on this fast-track authority?
Yeah, he's the leading Democrat within the committee that is in charge of, you know, moving this through the Senate. So if he blocked the fast-track, that would do a lot for blocking the advancement of the TPP.
Well, thank you so much, Paige, and we will continue to check in and see if you are able to get an audience with Ron Wyden or someone in his immediate household as far as this fast-track authority that he is now leaning towards granting the president in order to push through the Trans-Pacific Partnership Trade Agreement. Paige with Portland Central America Solidarity Committee. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
At the Oregon State Capitol in Salem today, the House Committee on Business and Labor heard testimony about a proposed bill that will allow working parents to attend school events. The bill, if passed, will require Oregon employers to grant employees unpaid parental leave to attend certain school-related activities. Leslie Sutton from the Oregon Developmental Disabilities Coalition is one of those who testified.
They have hundreds or thousands of families who contact them to say, sure, you're telling us parent involvement in these meetings is really important. You're helping us understand what our role in parent input in these documents is. I just can't get there. And the schools can't meet with us outside of school hours. So the people who need to be in the room to have these conversations about really important life course setting plans for these kids can't make that happen. So that's the IEP issue, which we believe is already covered in this bill. So we do support the bill. The other piece is disability support planning. So in addition to these required meetings with schools, which need to happen during the school day, there are disability support services that are really a lifeline for families outside of the school day. So we have families who, in order to keep their children healthy and safe and able to live at home with their family, they need to rely on developmental disability services from their county and from the state. We have county programs and service coordinators who try very, very hard to accommodate schedules for families.
The bill will now move forward into the Oregon House for consideration.
The Oregon State Senate voted Thursday to dissolve Cover Oregon and merge the failed insurance exchange into an existing state agency. Two Republicans joined all 18 Democrats in approving the measure Thursday. It now heads to the House. The expensive failure of Cover Oregon's website was an embarrassment for former Governor John Kitzhaber. It prompted dueling lawsuits filed by the state of Oregon and the software giant Oracle, which was the main technology contractor. The change is largely bureaucratic. Oregon would continue operating an insurance exchange under President Barack Obama's health care law using a federal website. The management would be transferred away from the semi-autonomous corporation that now handles it to the Department of Consumer and Business Services. Lawyers for the state have told a federal judge that the bill would strengthen their agreement against Let me restate that, would strengthen their argument against Oracle's claim of copyright infringement. This is because the state is generally immune from litigation of that type under the U.S. Constitution. But an autonomous, privately run Cover Oregon could be subject to such a lawsuit.
Newly appointed Oregon Governor Kate Brown has decided to continue former Governor Kitzhaber's moratorium on death penalty executions. There are currently 34 male inmates on death row in Oregon and one female inmate. The decision to uphold the moratorium comes amid a growing national trend towards abolishing the death penalty entirely. This last year saw several states outlaw the death penalty, and there was momentum in the Washington state legislature to abolish it. KBOO's Ethan Martin spoke with Ron Steiner from Oregonians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty about this growing trend.
All right, my name is Ron Steiner. I'm the board chair of Oregonians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty.
Great. Well, so I kind of want to talk first about the newly enshrined Governor Kate Brown's continuation of former Governor Kitzhaber's moratorium on the death penalty. And Yeah, what's your view on that? Do you feel that her continuation of that moratorium is a step forward for the abolition of the death penalty in Oregon, and or in, how much is it not enough as well?
Well, I don't know a lot about it. I have had several reports about her statement at the press conference today, but to continue Governor Kitzhoffer's moratorium on executions in Oregon, I think, is a very good thing. Our organization views that as a very good thing. He was heroic and courageous to do it in the first place, and for Governor Brown to continue it, I would applaud.
What do you feel that she could do to further the movement towards abolition?
Well, I don't speak for her, so I'm not sure what her position is on it, but and from our position, continuing the debate on the death penalty is what's needed in this state. Our organization for a long time has been trying to promote the discussion and the dialogue around the death penalty that Governor Kitzhoffer called for originally. And we see that when people learn all of the facts and hear all the stories, they have a tendency to be a little more open to a full discussion.
Yeah, I was wondering if maybe you could talk about the national trend that kind of appears to be heading in the direction of abolitionism.
Very much so. And people can find the details if they would go to a website for Death Penalty Information Center. That's www.deathpenaltyinfo.org. In 2014, there was a continuation of the decline in district attorneys and prosecutors seeking death sentences. There were fewer sentences. There were fewer executions. There were only seven states that executed people last year. All of these numbers are down at sometimes two- and three-decade records. And we think the trend is moving very swiftly in the direction of repealing the death penalty nationally and hopefully in Oregon as well.
I know there's some talk up in the Washington legislature to try and introduce legislation to abolish the death penalty in that state. Do you know if there's any movement in the Oregonian legislature towards abolishing the death penalty here?
I really don't know. This is part of the discussion that I would guess is going on. We're trying to promote the discussions throughout the state in communities of all sizes, and I really don't know how intense the discussion is in the Capitol. There are certainly legislators on both sides of the issue, and that's for them to debate at some point down the line here.
So how does your organization promote the discussion in communities across the state? Maybe you could talk about that for a little bit.
Well, we encourage people to have discussion groups about it. We do this all the time in churches, in schools, in libraries, calling people together to say we'd like to discuss the death penalty. Our organization has a point of view. We're against executions and would like to get rid of it, but we try and create a safe space so that people who feel differently or are conflicted about the death penalty feel comfortable voicing their opinions. When we do these, we say, here are the typical arguments for the death penalty. Here are the typical arguments against the death penalty. Let's discuss it. Let's hear stories. Let's look at facts. And then people can make an informed decision. It's been my experience, and I've been involved in abolition for 15 years now. First in New Mexico, where we did repeal the death penalty in 2009, and since 2010 here in Oregon. It's my impression that everybody has an opinion and will say they are for it or against it, but not everybody has all the information that they need to make an informed decision. So that's what we're trying to do and create these debates. So we had one yesterday morning. We were planning another one last night out in McMinnville. We have them all over the state. We had one in Corvallis last week, trying to get people just to think about it, talk about it, learn about it, and focus on it.
Based on your experiences in Oregon through your organization, I was just wondering what your impression of Oregonians' kind of perspectives on the death penalty have been. Do you feel like they are trending towards not wanting to abolish the death penalty, or do you feel like there is a lot of sentiment that's in favor of abolishing the death penalty?
Well, I think there's a lot of people who would like to abolish the death penalty. I think there's more now than there used to be, and I also understand that there's people who support the death penalty. Our view is the death penalty doesn't provide any benefit to anybody except those who are looking for revenge and retribution. I've been involved for the last 6 or 7 years with a national organization called Murder Victim Families for Reconciliation. And these are over 4,000 members across the country, and there are many of them in Oregon, who have had that terrible experience of losing a loved one to murder. And they're not in favor of the death penalty, because what they've learned is there is no closure. They will never forget their loved one. It does not honor their loved one to commit another violent act in the form of execution. The trials that they're asked to go through year after year after year from the appeals are draining and tiring, and they would just like to reconcile, move on, and in some cases it even involves forgiveness. That's not necessarily the case with all of them, but they just find that the death penalty does not serve them well. And so there's no point in it. We're spending millions and millions of dollars to maintain it. We haven't executed anybody since 1997 and only two people since in the last 53 years. So we can do better. We have alternatives that keep the public safe in the form of life without parole, and we can do better as a state and as a people.
That was Ron Steiner with Oregonians for Alternatives to the Death Penalty, and this is Ethan Martin with KBOO News.
You are rocking out to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for media analysis from Counterspin, followed by Bread and Roses celebrating International Mother's Language Day at 6. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is cloudy early, then becoming sunny with a high of 58, while on Sunday it'll be a high of 55. Today in history, in 1943, American movie executives agreed to allow the Office of War Information to monitor and censor all movies. Also on this day last year in 2014, dozens of anti-government protesters are shot dead in the Ukrainian capital of Kiev, presumably by snipers. The quote of the day is from Rainier Marie Rilke, who said, "Once the realization is accepted that even between the closest human beings, infinite distances continue, a wonderful living side by side can grow, and if they succeed in loving the distance between them, which makes it possible for each to see the other whole against the sky."
It is just right about 5:22 in the afternoon here on KBOO, and it's time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
When you get fed up with all the greed and narcissism that seems to rule our country, a good way to restore your faith in humankind is to reflect on the generosity of Ron Reed, the philanthropist of Dummerston, Vermont. Mr. Reed was not a splashy, self-celebrating, David Koch, Michael Dell, Richard DeVos type, whose altruism is dependent on how prominently their names are displayed on the facilities they endow. In fact, no one in Dummerston had a clue that Ronald James Reed was a man of wealth, much less a benefactor, until he died at age 92. Known around town as Ron, he was a quiet, unassuming, hard-working, and well-liked fellow who spent 25 years as a gas station employee, then 17 more as a janitor at the local JCPenney store. He drove a second-hand Yaris, gathered and cut down limbs for firewood, used safety pins to hold his well-worn coat together, and hated seeing anything go to waste. Some knew that Mr. Reed enjoyed collecting stamps and that he often checked out books from the local library. It was only after his death, however, that the town learned about another little hobby he enjoyed, picking stocks and making small investments. Turns out he was very, very good at it, which is how he was able to become a philanthropist. This February, local folks were astonished and delighted to learn that their modest neighbor had bequeathed $1.2 million to their library, the largest gift in its 129 years, doubling its endowment. He also gave $4.8 million to the area's hospital, the largest bequest it ever received. This is Jim Hightower saying he didn't even wait around for a public thank you, much less demand that he get tax write-offs and have his name engraved on the library facade. Mr. Ron Reed is an exemplar philanthropist, a genuine altruist who invested in the future of the common good.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
Today, attorneys from the Center for Constitutional Rights called on a federal court to dismiss a terrorism indictment against two animal right activists. The activists are accused of freeing thousands of animals from Midwestern fur farms. They were indicted under the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, but their attorney claims that the act is unconstitutional and should be struck down. The Center for Constitutional Rights said in its court's filing today that the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act is a poorly disguised attempt to chill legitimate advocacy by an unpopular group of activists. The Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act punishes causing damage or loss to a business or other institution that sells animals or animal products. This includes both lost profits caused by criminal acts and loss caused by boycotts, picketing, and other constitutionally protected activity. The attorney said freeing animals is not terrorism and that the government has admitted that it is not terrorism, but continues to convict activists as if it is. Despite this fact, if the two Illinois-based activists are found guilty of freeing animals, the defendants will be convicted and labeled as terrorists for life. They could be placed in highly restrictive prison conditions, and as a result, they might have to disclose the nature of their convictions to employers, academic institutions, and others in the future.
A new report published in the journal Science by the U.S. Geological Survey connects increased seismic activity to hydraulic fracking in states like Oklahoma, Texas, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. The small but frequent quakes are specifically linked to the powerful injection of wastewater into the Earth's crust in order to loosen natural gas deposits. The U.S. Geological Survey, seeking to establish a common interest discussion aimed at minimizing these earthquakes, has called for greater transparency and cooperation amongst financially invested parties in the fracking industry. So far, the oil and gas industry has been consistently private with data gathered during the fracking boom of the past few years, neglecting to divulge which toxic chemicals are being injected along with the wastewater. The Geological Survey says that it is necessary for invested parties, communities, and government agencies to share data if they are to effectively address and minimize the dangerous increase in seismic activity. Ohio alone experienced 400 small quakes over the annual average in 2014, 77 of which occurred in the small town of Poland Township, a place that previously had no seismic activity. Along with the connection to increased seismic activity, fracking has been linked to contaminated groundwater supplies, community health defects, and exacerbation of drought conditions. Increasing awareness of the negative environmental and health effects of fracking have led to efforts by communities to ban the industry, efforts which have often been undermined by state governments and the gas industry. Nevertheless, some communities have been successful in preventing the practice from becoming established, and New York became the first state to outright ban the controversial industry last December.
One of the world's top universities, Harvard, is currently engaged in a legal standoff with students who are trying to get the university to divest from fossil fuels. Today, the students appeared in court to challenge the lawyers of Harvard University's administration to challenge their argument that their protest is an illegal form of coercion. The students are trying to get the Ivy League school to divest of its $36 million endowment from the fossil fuel industry. The lawsuit filed by 7 graduate and undergraduate students last fall argues that Harvard's continued holdings in oil, gas, coal, and related sectors is, quote, a mismanagement of charitable funds, end quote. According to the complaint by the students, the fossil fuel industry affects the ability of students to study and thrive free from the threat of catastrophic climate change. They argue today in court that every person has a responsibility to confront the reality of climate change, which currently poses and will continue to pose serious dangers to the most vulnerable. They said that their university has a legal obligation and a moral duty to stop profiting from human suffering and environmental destruction. Last week, dozens of students staged a sit-in in the administrative building as a way to confront university leadership on the issue of fossil fuel divestment.
In the midst of controversy over the Israeli Prime Minister's plans to address Congress next month, a researcher has won the release of a decades-old Defense Department report detailing the U.S. government's extensive help to Israel in that nation's development of a nuclear bomb. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with a researcher, Grant Smith, from the Institute for Research, Middle Eastern Policy.
I wonder if you could tell us about the 1987 report that you were able to uncover recently.
Sure. First of all, the report was a collection of studies done for the Reagan administration back in 1987. Of various countries' technology base. And the report was released after we sued the Department of Defense. And it contains a number of really interesting allegations, probably the most important of which is that the American-supplied SORIC nuclear reactor, which was given by the Eisenhower administration under the Atoms for Peace program, is being used as a nuclear weapons research and development facility. And that the Israelis, according to this report, have a program to produce hydrogen bombs, laser enrichment of uranium. And as the report basically says, the sophistication level is every bit as sophisticated as Los Alamos and Oak Ridge National Laboratories, which are, quote, the principal U.S. laboratories that developed the bomb for the United States, unquote. So it's a really interesting report because usually the American government either doesn't confirm or deny the existence